You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Thank you so much for being here. I didn't realize this was the last panel ever, so this is going to be the best thing that you actually hear, because it's going to be the last thing you hear. My name's Kester. I'm an associate director at a research and development institute called the Institute for the Future of Work. So I spend my days thinking about how AI and automation technologies are changing work in the UK. And for me, the kind of core thing is that all technologies are social. AI, you know, whatever it is, pens, nothing is just a tool. Everything has relational impacts, and that's why it's important that we discuss those together. And the book Godlike, I'll be sharing a signing with Hannah, who'll be speaking in a moment straight afterwards. That the title of that book came from an article that Ian Hogarth, who's one of the government's leads on AI safety, wrote for the FT, where he said, "We must pause the race towards godlike AI." And I was like, "Oh, interesting terms. You know, you've gone quite theological there, government advisor on AI safety. What do you mean by that?" But of course, all technologies are in some way social, and then in some ways, then they're all slightly theological. One of the key stories in that book is a conversation that was overheard between two complete AI pioneers, and I mean this. You know, these really were complete pioneers. Doug Engelbart, who went on to lead the Center for the Augmentation of Human Intellect at Stanford Research Institute, which is where you get the name Siri from on your phone, SRI, and also Marv Minsky. And both of them were kind of thinking about how these technologies could work. And Marv Minsky turned to Doug Engelbart really excitedly, this is in the 1950s, and said, "It's amazing, like, we're going to make machines intelligent. We're going to make machines conscious." And Engelbart turned to Minsky and said, "You're going to do all that for machines? What are you going to do for the people?" And that really is the kind of core interest of this panel, which is going to be kind of emerging out to you guys. Look, these technologies are existing, but what are we going to do in terms of us, our response together? This isn't a panel about AI, and we're using that term because it's a whole collection of different technologies. This is a panel about our response in the context of this thing. So, you know, straight off the bat, I want to thank you for being here. This is a kind of justice arts festival. It's you know, been a lot here about social justice, about climate, about the genocide in Gaza. But in a sense, all of those have got technological and AI dimensions. At the heart of those issues. If you're an artist, you've been ripped off by AI. You may be here because you're interested in IP and copyrights. If you're interested in the climate crisis, then you've got to be interested in what the hell is happening with AI. And if you're interested in, you know, what's happening in terms of war and, you know, these kind of terrible disasters of conflict, then so much of those conflicts are algorithm-driven, whether that's through the identification of targets smartly, intelligently. All of this is kind of being done by AI. And it's absolutely incumbent on us not to walk away, but to engage. As artists, as climate activists, as people interested in justice, we have to be there thinking about AI. The other story I tell in the book is about Mary Shelley's fantastic novel Frankenstein, and the kind of key trauma at the heart of that book is that Dr. Frankenstein creates this monster, this creature, and then the stupid bastard, he walks away. He fails to take responsibility for his own creation and abdicates that, and the monster goes off and kind of learns from what's around them and becomes truly troubled. And very quickly, the kind of key quote from the novel is, "Remember, thou hast made me more powerful than thyself. Remember that I am thy creature. I ought to be thy Adam, but rather I am instead become the fallen angel." That, I think, is the problem unless we engage with these key technologies. That is fundamental to what we're here to talk about, is to try and model today being more reflective about that. If you heard my talk on AI last year, you'll have heard me talk about, if we think about an incredibly simple technology like a hammer, all technologies amplify our ability to act in the world. And a hammer does that. It allows me to apply greater force with my hand. So, you know, I can't push nails into the wall with my thumb. I can do it with a hammer. But as I grip the hammer, it comes back through the arm into the heart and says, what do you want to do with this amplified power? And all technologies do this. They amplify our reach in the world, but they ask us a question about what we want to do with that greater power. And the greater power of the technology, the more profound those questions become. So profound, in fact, that the only way we can answer the question of what we're going to do with these algorithmic technologies, wide as they are, is to answer those questions together. We cannot get those answers just as we've not been able to do with, how can I spend less time on my phone? We can't answer that on our own. We've got to come together to be able to do that. So in essence, that's what we're going to model in this session, is thinking about how can we be more reflective about our technology use, but not do that just us, because we haven't got the strength to do that, but do that in our communities of practice, whether that's a church or a trades union or a kind of, you know, worker collective or whatever it might be. But I'm really, really thrilled to have two wonderful experts with me here today. I'm going to allow them just to kind of speak about their approaches to this question of AI and the people. And we're going to kick off with the wonderful Hannah, who has written this absolutely brilliant book, Marchild the Argument. And you can tell us a bit about that. So thank you so much. She's going to be in the bookshop after this as well. Hannah, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Kester. Oh, I can't resist messing around with mics. So because this has been billed as a panel for the people and a panel about people, I'm going to not do what I would normally do, I suppose, and introduce myself as a writer, and I've been making theatre and I do this and that for 20 years. I'll introduce myself as a person, and the person that I was when I started working on this project, My Child, The Algorithm, which is a book. It's a bit like a memoir. I never would have called it that at the beginning, but it's about my life and my experiences as a queer single parent. And it's about love. It's about raising my child. And I wrote it at a time, or coming out of a time, where everything in my life had suddenly changed. I thought I was going to be bringing up, I thought I was going to be living with my partner at the time, another woman. In fact, I carried her egg, and I gave birth. So we both contributed to our baby. And 2 weeks after I gave birth, we separated. Which was very sudden and also not sudden, and something that had been coming for really since I became pregnant. So that put me in a very different state in all sorts of ways. I was a new parent. I was heartbroken every day, every night, but I also had to be there for my baby. I couldn't lose it. I was on my own suddenly. I was like, how am I going to afford this? I found out about universal credit. I found out that I qualified for it. I also found out that maternity leave and universal credit was not going to cover the costs. Later at the time when I was writing this book, it did more because I was working at the same time. But I also then found out just after writing this book that as a single parent on universal credit, you cannot find rental housing in this country. Regardless of how much money, well, no. If you have money underneath about 60K a year in London, that is. My life was in a different kind of state, and a state that made me a bit more open to the world and to encounters with new people, other parents and friends and dating. And I didn't want to kind of shut down into this kind of new small world, but really open it up, which obviously was a bit challenged by COVID when that happened. But one of the things I started to do at this time was I met a cognitive scientist who was working with large language models. This was before the release of ChatGPT. This is before anyone in the kind of general public really had started talking about it. And I started playing with this large language model and feeding it questions that I had about my life, about love, about being a queer single parent. And it came back with not answers, because it wasn't a chatbot. The way we are limited with the interface that we might work with today, given to us by big tech, it's a limited chat box with parameters on it. This was a very wild, early, open source, grassroots developed version that went wrong a lot. It glitched a lot. It failed. It would kind of glitch on repeating lines like, failed to save the world as it ought to be, but there is a but. And like, I will go on my own and I will be fine. I will go on my own and I will be fine. And these phrases started to kind of repeat in my mind. Repeating and repeating, which is a similar way in which my mind works, and it's a similar way in which my child's mind works. At that time, he was glitching on phrases like Miss Mum, he calls his other parent Mum. Miss Mum, Mummy, Miss Mum, Mummy, and then Miss Mum on the phone, Mummy, Miss Mum on the phone, Mummy, because he was interacting with her through a phone screen. So this algorithm that I was working with and the child that I was working with had both been fed a whole soup of material, were picking up everything that was around them and were processing it in very different ways, of course. But these processes were happening simultaneously to me and to my life, and were starting to infiltrate the way I thought and the way I wrote. And this algorithm text said to me, if you want to write about love, you've got to look at your life. The answers are in your life. And I say it kind of tricked me into writing about myself and my life for the first time and into becoming quite honest. And sometimes it said the things that I couldn't say. And again, it was not a chatbot that I interacted with. It was something that produced a whole load of material, which then I spliced into this text. And I always differentiate in italics when it's there. Sometimes it was very funny. I asked it to write me a scene depicting codependency between two women in love. And it wrote breasts, 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 265 times, and then concluded, all women in love. So I had a lot of fun with it, and there is a lot of fun in this book, and it's not about the difficulties or the kind of the trauma of being on my own and with a baby. It's about a joy of discovering language and discovering a new way of living and of discovering alternatives in the way in which I think, the way in which I write, and the way in which I parent and live and love. And the word that alternatively intelligent, that phrase, I took that from Jeanette Winterson, who wrote in 12 Bytes, let's not call it artificial intelligence. Alternative intelligence is more accurate. We need alternatives, which I think is very true and is the way I like to keep thinking about it. Now I'm thinking more about alternative intelligences. For instance, I'm thinking about neurodivergent thought as an alternative intelligence. I'm interested in neuroqueering the algorithm and in how working with these tools can tell us more about the ways in which humans think and the ways in which humans create. And so we have to maybe allow the models to be messy and wrong and glitchy, because this is how humans access creativity. And I think there's something very disappointing about the way AI, and again, it's not AI, it's not artificial, and it's not intelligent, as Kate Crawford has said, but the ways in which these models are always pitted against humans, large language model versus human writer, competing to see who writes the best. This is nonsense. The ways in which writers, if writers do engage with these tools, if we can, if we are, you know, allowed to play with them and work with creative tools, we'll be working with them. You won't be able to say this is from this and this is from that. It's ways of creating new ways of writing, new ways of thinking. But to do that, we have to value creativity. We have to value the arts and we have to value writers. And this society really doesn't. And it's why it was lovely to hear some applause after Jeremy Corbyn talking about the arts and valuing the arts, because I feel very, very devalued. I am not valued. And that's not just because of AI stealing writers' books. That's the publishing industry. That's the whole model that is our whole publishing industry is based on. It's only available for rich people who have other forms of income. Those people can write books. If you're sustained by academia, if you're sustained by a partner, if you have money in other ways. The publishing industry is built on unpaid labor of writers. And yes, some writers, of course, that's not the case. But for the majority, we are providing unpaid labor for free to make money for publishers. We don't get paid to write books. We don't generally get paid very much to promote books. And there's a whole load of work that is expected. And it's a gamble. The publishing industry gambles because some books might make it. But then let's take that to AI. Well, the same model takes place. It's easy for publishers to be anti-AI because humans are cheaper. They don't need to replace us. We're cheaper. But we are now giving our unpaid labor to make money for big tech. And of course, that's not just writers, that's all of us here. So I wonder if this big shift and this kind of changes that have been happening over recent years due to alternative intelligence, we might call it, or really due to big tech, is it an opportunity? Is it going to make things a hell of a lot worse? Do we need that to happen to actually look at what we value in society, whether we value human thought, human creativity, how we might work with alternative intelligences or AI or large language models to develop and change this, but really how can we value the human? How can we put value back onto the human? Something that I want to do is transform large language models from tools of linguistic prediction into collaborators in linguistic subversion, which is a line I wrote with AI, with a large language model, with the support of it. I think I'll finish in one moment, but just off, maybe there's something that the algorithm said in this book, which is the human brain is perfect. They're perfect machines. There is no algorithm for a human.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Hannah. That sense in which it is important that we actually value ourselves as one of the first things that we do, because very often we are being devalued. You know, it's not that we search Google, that Google searches us, and that is because we have not necessarily understood ourselves. We are very much alienated from ourselves by these tech things and alienated from one another. That puts technology companies in a great position because they can then do that work of kind of, I suppose, manipulation or whatever, whether that's in the media in terms of feeding narratives and those sorts of things. So these technologies, in the way that they interact with us as people, it's incumbent upon us to understand who we are and how we are valued as people, and to do that together and to do that across all the different communities that we are a part of. I want to bring in James, who is one of the most living legend people in tech in this country. So I'll let him explain why, and if he doesn't, I'm going to explain for you. But over to you, James Stewart. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Kester. My background is as a technologist and also a longtime green belter, probably best known for the work that I did in the UK government, where I led the building of gov.uk and a lot of work behind that to try and help government get better at taking opportunities in the digital age. By which we, I mean technology, but more, how can we imagine our organizations? How do we structure ourselves to make better decisions, make use of the feedback loops that the digital era has given us to put citizens, users of services, more at the center of things? That is a long, hard challenge in any large institution. Seems to be where I've found myself spending my life doing that now, more with international institutions and funders who are investing massively around the world in all sorts of areas of digital transformation, but often need a lot of help thinking beyond the technology to what's the institutional change and how do we do that in a human-centered way that gets success. For me, it's been great to be here this weekend and have this panel coming up right at the end of the festival, because it's meant all weekend just been talking about this stuff with people. A few things that have really struck me. One, no big surprise, but everybody's caught up in the positive and negative sides of the hype cycle we find ourselves in. We find everybody is seeing stories about AI everywhere. It's coming up in all sorts of areas of life. Scare stories, positive stories, it's really hard to navigate. And in many ways, that's kind of a natural part of this stage of any kind of technology development. It's happening much more in public than any previous major technology change, but there's still a kind of uncertainty, finding the parameters of the technology, getting to grips with what could its social impact be. The writer Clay Shirky said technology tends to become socially interesting when it becomes technically boring. I don't think that holds true this time. Which makes it even harder for us to grasp it than some previous ones. But there's a real challenge of, we're often responding to anecdotes. We've heard this story about something that's happening, perhaps because of AI. We pin it on, this is the AI doing something. It's never the AI doing something. It's people doing things, perhaps with something we might call AI. but we also extrapolate from that. It's happening in one place, so it must be happening everywhere. And we generally don't have any data to work that out. And that means we're swimming in an uncertainty, and it's quite difficult for us to find our way through it. And that's kind of true in almost every conversation I've had this weekend with people at Greenbelt. Also reflected in all the big institutions I work with, where politicians particularly are being pushed upon for having some big, bold pronouncement. And I don't know if anybody's looked at the headlines today, but there's a whole thing about Peter Kyle, Secretary of State for Innovation and Technology, discussing buying a ChatGPT license for the whole country. Now, Peter Kyle had a conversation about that. Of course he had a conversation about that. Of course he talks to Sam Altman, who runs OpenAI. Doesn't mean he's actually going to do it. But he is under pressure to make those sorts of pronouncements. And in that context, I think it becomes really hard for us to find the space to be more imaginative about what is possible with these technologies and how do we want to model them. So I've talked quite a lot about an experiment a friend of mine who runs a publishing company has done of using a smaller language model embedded in the content that he publishes. It's technical content. It's probably quite different from kind of literature and poetry and other kind of publishing, but because it's sort of education based in a very specific way. But to understand how can he actually enrich the experience of that content in a way that creates more money for his authors. In doing that, he's modeled a different vision of how these things might work from everything becomes about one of four platforms. And I think it's really important that we carve out more space to do that kind of thinking, imagining, experimenting. The other thing that kind of comes with that is what stories we tell and what metaphors we use. It's very easy to fall into the AI and start using consciousness metaphors. And there was a really good piece by Mustafa Suleiman, who's the CEO of Microsoft AI, last week about actually the huge risks, both for him as an AI researcher, but for us as a society, if we continue to use a consciousness metaphor to think about where AI is going, we stop thinking about the tool. We stop thinking about how do we have agency over using something. We start othering it in a way that's really unhelpful. But I think the most hopeful thing that I've had this weekend is realizing here's yet another incredibly skilled, thoughtful, multidisciplinary crowd of people. So people have talked to software engineers, people have talked to literature professors, people have talked to doing all sorts of different things, all of which touch on this space. And the sense that, you know, we can only do that work of experimenting and imagining if we kind of connect cross-functionally, cross-discipline, so that you've got the understanding of a context, you've got the understanding of the technology tightly together. And I think if we need to create structures for bringing people together like that, to then meaningfully connect all that's going on with human lives.
Yeah, that's amazing. And if you ever used gov.uk, that was James. Absolutely incredible. So big round. What a website that is, you know. As you can tell from my broad Yorkshire accent, I was born in Sheffield. But I spent the first few years of my life in a mining village. And actually, back in the 1950s, a really fascinating theory which was developed called socio-technical systems theory, which began down coal mines. And it used to be the case, you'd have a gang of people who would go down there and they'd put up a tunnel, kind of put up the explosives, blow out the stuff, and then bring the coal out. And that gang would do the whole lot. And then some clever chaps during the Second World said, well, we can make this more efficient. We'll have one gang of people who specialize in going down there, and they'll put up the tunneling. Then a different bunch of people will go down and, you know, lay all the explosives and blow it up. And then another gang of people will go down and get all the coal out. This will be so much more efficient. And productivity nosedived. And they really had to think about why. And it was because the relationships within that gang of people working together had been completely destroyed by this introduction of a more technical system. And out of that came this theory called socio-technical system theory, which understood that if you want to get the best out of a whole system, you need to jointly optimize both the technical and the social dimensions. And my concern is that an enormous amount of money and effort and what have you has gone into the technical capabilities of these systems. And what has been impoverished at firm level and other levels has been the idea of investing in people and the social systems. And guess what? It's probably going to be down to us to actually have to model how to do that, because we've got to play catch up. If we don't play catch up, the technical systems just to get to entirely dominate that narrative and get to entirely dominate what that conversation looks like. And as Hannah said, what that means is you end up with an AI system that is just a chatbot that is completely boring and it doesn't do anything kind of interesting. We need to kind of re-grasp that social element. And what that looks like for me day to day is when we go into firms to talk to them about, you know, thinking about adopting an AI system, we don't talk to them about technology. We talk to them about their values. Who are you as a firm? Why did you turn up to work today? What is it that you want to do? Getting to the heart of the social aspect is then about how you understand how the technology can bring about that innovation and help you with that. And that's what, interestingly, Hannah was talking about, that those two AI pioneers who I talked about right at the beginning, Marv Minsky was all about AI. He coined the term artificial intelligence. Doug Engelbart would have none of it. He talked about intelligence augmentation, IA. And we've lost that. Or we are in danger of losing that if we don't have conversations as people about, okay, you know, how are we going to integrate these things into our lives, into our parenting, into the kind of ways in which we work as firms and as people? Because guess what? If we don't have those conversations, that the kind of technological narrative will be foisted upon us, because there is billions and billions of dollars of capital that needs extracting back to pay for these things. So it's extremely important that we have that agency. You will have seen adverts all over the place for agentic AI, these AI agents that will kind of read your emails and reply on your behalf and all that. And I say, absolutely not. We need to restore our own agency into these systems. We need to have the agency as artists, as writers, as technologists, as kind of software engineers, to be able to lead those narratives. Why? For the people. That's really kind of what that is about. Hannah, I wanted to throw a quote back at you. In your book, you talk about today's algorithms are no more human, but they wear a mask, a human mask, that doesn't slip. That kind of made me absolutely sit up and think, gosh, that mask not slipping anymore is kind of very, very proud. And I just wondered if we need, dare I say, more queer AIs to help us understand how to navigate these technologies.
Yeah, I don't know if the queer AIs would help us navigate the technologies, but they would queer it, mess it up a bit in a maybe useful way. They're not allowed to slip anymore because they're not allowed, I mean, the guardrails that have been placed on them to prevent them spewing harmful content also prevents them from spewing poetic content and surprising and, you know, all of the kind of glitchy, wonderful things that I worked with in this book. Is very incredibly difficult to get the commercial models to produce anything this creative. For me, I've tried. So yeah, I do. I think we need, and again, as you were saying, James, it's not one thing. And what we might need is, and I mean, people are developing it, but multiple models, not to be dominated by big tech and just a few competitors, but multiple models for different things, like queer models, neuroqueer models, neurodivergent models that, you know, glitch and repeat in the ways in which my neurodivergent mind does, queerer models. You know, ridiculous models, but really making them go right limits them, whatever that means, whatever right means, but it limits them so much. And I suppose that's it. They're not oracles. They're not things that we should go to for answers about anything, but they're a way of working with material. I mean, from a creative perspective anyway, of reorganizing and working with material and putting a lot of things together and accessing huge resources of creativity, potentially, that can lead to new ideas and new ways of working and new ways of thinking. But that's very challenging with the commercial models.
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously, you know, we say AI, what we don't mean is ChatGPT. These are completely, you know, a vast kind of number of technologies. James, there's going to be people who are immediately thinking, hold on a minute, carbon. We were talking earlier, and you mentioned the story about you're working with the government of Iceland. Yeah. I wondered if you could just tell us a little bit about that, and that beautifully kind of widened the conversation around that?
Yeah, I think this is obviously a huge topic and probably deserves at least one session of its own. But a lot of the work that I did in the UK government was looking at where can we improve with the user experience and then the efficiency for government by digitizing things. And mostly that was looking at where are things failing at the moment for citizens, which creates cost. And building on some of that learning, we did some work a few years ago with the government of Iceland, who were looking to invest more heavily in digitizing their services, moving them online primarily. Wanted to understand the cost of that, what economic case should they make for it, but also what's the carbon cost of doing that. And the starting point was, this is all going to be net new carbon that we're creating, and we need to understand like how much is going to be used in the data centers, how much is used on the devices that people use to interact with things. But it seemed important to us to really understand the overall service people were accessing and what the status quo was. And we found that loads of Iceland services were delivered face-to-face, which some people need, and you don't want to completely get rid of that. But a lot of people didn't intrinsically need to access those face-to-face. They just had to, because that was the only option. And they typically drove to a government office repeatedly to access that. And once you started to calculate the cost of that, those journeys and of maintaining those offices at that size and heating them and all of those things, the data costs were minuscule, like the data centers and everything else, which for me sort of spoke to the need to always think at least one level up from whatever specific use of a technology we're making. There's an old sort of saying, if you're designing a chair, think about the room it's going to be in. And if you're thinking about designing a room, think about the house it's going to be in. I think we always need to take that same approach to thinking about something like the environmental cost of AI. It's not just what net new things are we doing, but also what does that displace for good or for ill? And what's the impact of that? And once we do that, it's much, much harder to reason about this stuff. It's also a lot more ambiguous whether we're generating problems or benefits.
And also, I mean, interestingly, you may be thinking, well, I don't use AI. You know, I'm a writer. I don't use AI. Actually, the vast majority of the carbon cost of AI is through things like recommendation engines. If you use Spotify or if you use Google or if you use other kind of, you know, Facebook, those sorts of things. It's not you using AI to kind of summarize a document. Actually, the vast majority of these algorithmic carbon costs are for things that just seem to be in the background anyway, which was a total revelation to me. So that means, okay, if I want to maybe minimize my carbon cost and I want to use an LLM for something, maybe I need to think about, where do I store my photos? How long do I store my emails? Do I kind of need to do a bit of data destruction to make sure that I'm not using so much in the cloud, just to use some theological language, all the time? You know, in perpetuity up in heaven, the data there. We want to help people understand that all of this requires us to be able to reflect together about our technology use. As I've said before, the Amish get a bad press. Great film with Han Solo, who's that guy? But the Amish, at least they were reflective about technology. They drew the line in a different place. They still do up their clothes, but they use buttons, but not zips. We need to actually be better as communities of people reflecting on, okay, what's the right line for us and how we're going to do that together? You may be starting to think about a question that you've got. And because this is about trying to model that specifically for this panel, you may want to just spend a moment like speaking to the person next to you. Well, that was my question. And then maybe widen that out. So just like for 30 seconds, 45 seconds to kind of broaden out where those questions are. And then we're going to start opening it out and have a bit of a wider discussion. So turn to the person next to you, like, what's the question that you had? And share those questions, maybe broaden them out into little groups so that we can begin to model this idea of being reflective about tech use. And then we're going to get the mics going around and build up into a bit of a discussion.
What tools can we put in place as communities and, you know, push our governments to enforce to stop monopolies, so that if a person wants to swap which tools they're using between different suppliers, they are free to do so?
James.
I mean, there's loads of discussion about that, about governments. One of the challenges, as I was sort of alluding to, is the technology space is changing quite a lot, and that makes it quite hard to shape standards. The things like the AI Act in Europe have made some attempts. I think for me, a really important thing that's currently missing is just any kind of transparency reporting from a lot of the big players in this space, whether it's about their carbon use, whether it's about how people are using their platforms. There's some really interesting work being done at the Institute for Innovation and Public Purpose at UCL about what would the equivalent of the generally accepted accounting principles be for tech platforms to get more meaningful understanding of what's going on there that would then let us kind of get into that. And at a government level, it's that kind of stuff. What's the audit regime and other things that are really important, as well as creating financing for people to explore other models. I think as communities, the reason I was sort of talking about my friend's publishing company and what he was doing is it's very easy for us as communities to say we don't like monopolies. It's much harder to point at what else do we want and how do we balance the benefits and challenges in that. And that's where I think finding multidisciplinary groups of people who can explore that, create models, and by that I don't mean large language models, I mean kind of operating models and ways of using tools and playing with them that might point at what is the alternative to monopolies, what world do we want to create, and that's the thing that I think we need a lot more of to complement anything that governments might do.
That multidisciplinary thing is hugely, hugely important, because very often these technologies are extraordinarily kind of black box. It may be that you're in the room and your closest experience of an AI is actually in an HR situation. Maybe you've been applying for like 300 jobs and you've not managed to land an interview or something. And that can be an extremely disheartening experience, because you're sending your CV off. It's probably being read and screened by an algorithm. Maybe you're not getting a shift next week because you didn't smile enough last week, because there is a system which is trying to track your emotions at work. These systems do exist. And because it's not scored you very highly on smiling, it's not offering you a shift next week. This is not about writing tools or creative tools. This is about algorithmic decision-making tools that are making decisions about us by reading our data. For example, you may be working in a temperature-controlled environment in a warehouse, and they give you a little monitor to make sure that you don't get too cold in that. And that's kind of monitoring your temperature, and is also making some kind of predictive thing in an HR situation about whether you're trying to get pregnant, and preemptively firing you for that. That is a real use case. Those sorts of things, it's very difficult for us to understand how that algorithm is working when it's just one of us. But when you've got communities of people who are technologists, software people, you know, those working in HR, if this is in a firm situation or in another organizational situation, we can bring our different voices and experiences to that together. This is why actually trades unions are becoming doubly more important, because it's only at the kind of corporate collective impact that you can understand if you've been discriminated against. If I don't get a shift next week, I don't know, I've got no idea why. If we can track that as a collective of people, then we begin to be able to hold accountability for these systems in a much, much richer way, which is why it's so important that those kind of black box things are exploded. Have we got another question? And we'll try to diversify the questions out a little bit as much as possible. Yes, from this. Yeah, we'll take one in.
My question is, how do you take that time to reflect on how you're going to use the tools when they're forced upon you?
Anna. Creative practice.
In what ways do you feel they're forced upon you? So I know what the context is. Sorry. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
When you're on like a Google search and it gives you like the AI summary, when you're on Facebook and your friend posts something and it gives you some AI options on how you might want to respond.
Yeah.
Things like that. So things where we're not consciously choosing to use it, but it's, so if you're consciously trying not to use it, it's really hard to avoid it.
Yeah. And I think especially for younger people who haven't had any other kind of Google search, I presume it's even more tempting to only take that top AI summary, which are often, so often incorrect.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, personally, I know that they're often incorrect, so I don't use them and look through other sources. But I think this is also a thing that's really going to impact education, schools and universities, and how, and the population in general. You know, how do we avoid seeing these things as oracles? Just because it comes up in one click immediately doesn't mean it's correct or accurate. Just because you know, an automated voice says it back to us when we speak to Alexa, you know, doesn't mean that that's the truth. And it's much harder somehow to critique something that we haven't produced. I don't know if you find that, but I think often working, if you work with these models and they'll write a version of text for you or a summary. So on the surface look, you think, oh, that's good. That sounds much more professional. That's better than what I could have done. That, you know, and then you look behind the facade and realize it's empty. And if we are all exchanging empty communications, yeah, what does that mean to our community? And weirdly, if the large language models are better at being polite than we are, do we really want to continue being so polite? I don't know. Like, you know, we're kind of teaching these things in our own image, but actually, when I say our own image, it's not our own image. It's a very, very specific model that the developers are creating, which is generally a white, cis, male, global minority model. And again, where we're interacting with that every day, and it's really interesting because so many people hate it. I was at some talk the other day. It was a massive thing. I think it might have been the Royal Festival Hall. And we were asked who uses social media. I mean, I can ask you guys that now. Who uses social media? Yeah, that's really a lot. I can't. Yeah, majority. Who enjoys using social media? Yeah, this is really chilling. What? You know, what is this? This is something that we are doing and engaging with, you know, I'd say more than once a day, right? Like, a lot. So few people are enjoying it. What are we doing? And how do we look back at ourselves and go, actually, we don't want to be what we are told to be or to behave in the way we are being told to behave or we are predicted to behave? Yeah, I mean, for me, it's like this... This should be driving us to a point of actually rethinking the human. And to mention all the forms of intelligences and all the forms of thought and creativity that are not inside these models, all of the intelligence and ideas that are not written down in books and that have not been stolen. You know, we're in outrage about the books that have been stolen, but also there is so much from the global majority that is not in these models. There is so much intelligence in the body. And here we've got BSL showing us this, British Sign Language. And, you know, and now we've got companies who are developing AI interpreters. This right now could not be done by AI interpreters. You know, this real-time translation of what I'm saying, you know, but there are companies that are developing this and that may, on the one hand, improve access to websites and to services, and on the one hand, can be very, you know, very good, and on the other hand, remove the human from really important context. So, yeah, how are we removing the human, and how do we want to rethink the human? I guess, but yeah, it's a real problem that all of us are up against all the time. Yeah.
I think that idea of the body as a site of intelligence is extremely important. I used to teach mathematics, and over my time of teaching that, it was almost as if the experience of being a student was flattened and flattened and flattened and flattened until during COVID it was literally as thin as a glass screen. Now, of course, if you do that, you are reducing the number of senses with which you approach problem solving. So that... it's a really silly example, but there's a bunch of us in my road and we kind of share this kind of communal garden, and the lawnmower wasn't working and someone instinctively got out their phone and was like, what are you doing? Like, why are you going to Google like how to get the lawnmower started? But it's a reflex in all of us, and it's flattening down our senses that we bring to problems so that they make less sense. And we need to have more senses brought to that so that, you know, these other intelligences are only one kind of version of sense that can be made, whereas there are many other senses that we can bring to things. And we need to think about our bodies together as sites of intelligence, which are never going to be algorithmized, as it were. Yeah, let's have some other kind of emerging questions from the people. Yes, do we have a microphone?
Hi. I work as a statistician, and my job hasn't changed, but gradually the definition of AI has changed, so I'm now working AI. And the thing that worries me is not that it's becoming conscious, but that it's fundamentally flawed and bad science. And I think machine learning is bad science. You're just refitting models over and over every time you get it wrong. And it's basically not the scientific method. And the image I have is a very Old Testament one of people creating idols for themselves. So we think we've created something wonderful and better than human, but it's not. It's so much less intelligent than we are. And that's the real worry, that we put too much trust in our own tools that we've made and are flawed.
Thank you. There was another question over towards the back here as well. Can we get a microphone? He's wondering. Thank you. Yeah.
Hi. My question was, how do you future-proof organizations and organizational design to make sure that you're prioritizing that social aspect of that kind of social technological interaction?
Organizational design. That's a really, really great question around how we gather the senses in which we gather. I've been thinking a little bit about slime mold, which is does actually have a significance. Slime mold is really interesting because it's got individual spores that then, under certain environmental conditions, gather together to make a kind of massed organism. And it's in that massed organism state that they can sense the world and solve mazes and find food and those sorts of things. But what are the environmental conditions within which we move from individual into corporate states? So in terms of that organizational thinking, I want to say back, well, what are the environmental conditions within which it would feel better to be able to come together rather than to do Netflix and chill just on my own and kind of, you know, sit there? And what would the structures of that look like if we did then gather together? So many people have been harmed by organizations and structures and the ways in which they have been led and pushed and guided and excluded and included, that we need new models of how that's done. I'm not an expert in that at all, so I won't claim any expertise on that. But certainly, as we do that gathering, there needs to be thinking around, okay, who is going to do the ways in which those conditions are that keep that as a healthy gathering in order to steer that? I think that's going to be something that's emergent. It's got to be complex. It's got to be drawing from different voices and making sure that that evolves like that, rather than it being that kind of dictatorial thing. We are here. I'm in control. I'm the leader. I'm going to guide that. So don't know, but know that it's super important to be able to do that. James?
I'll just throw it on that. I mean, there's as ever, many, many components to that. I think a huge one is really about starting to shift what organizations celebrate internally. And usually that is around often sort of making big announcements or hitting predictable targets. And where I've seen organizations most effectively start to adopt new structures is where firstly work out something they want to achieve in terms of the purpose of the organization and get better at talking about what the purpose of their organization is. And then start with something small that they'll deliver in a very different way and celebrate both what works and what doesn't about that, and start to seed from a really small initiative a different way of talking about what they do and what they should celebrate and how they're learning. There's then loads of like big work of rewiring budgeting systems and thinking about leadership training and all sorts of other things that come. But most organizations that seem to change and seem to be heading in a positive, I'm always worried about future proofing because that assumes we know a lot more about the future than we do, but are in a much better state for that, usually start with picking something small that they're going to commit to doing in a very different way. Usually connecting the practitioners involved in that and the leaders of the organization in a way that they're not used to.
Yeah. Thank you.
I've got a question to do with the economics and employment. There's undoubtedly AI is making my role more efficient. And as we become more efficient and potentially need less workers, are we going to end up concentrating money and finance into the hands of a few? And how does that impact then on tax and the finances of a country?
Shall I take a stab at that? Yeah, I mean, this is partly where the organisation I work for spent 3 years researching exactly this. Some of you may have seen we're talking headlines about, I mean, who's got any coverage around here? Who's seen any headlines the last few days? Which is a good thing. There was a study released recently. 95% of AI adoptions in firms of a particular sort have failed recently. It's just not really working. And that stat did not surprise me one bit, because there's been this huge promise that we're going to be able to make things super efficient. And you just kind of, you know, you're a business leader, oh my God, I've got to go efficiency, I'm going to bring in an AI model. And there's no consultation with the people throughout that structure, throughout that organization, throughout that firm, about what that looks like from the design, development, and deployment. So what you end up doing is just kind of hacking people off, increasing disengagement, that sort of thing. That model of we're just going to replace people is very, very being pushed hard, and we need to resist it very, very strongly. Partly because this is about us as people, and work is a good thing. Work is joyous. It gives us a sense of purpose and meaning. It's a golden thread that holds communities together, and it kind of sustains them and what have you. But also for the fiscal thing, if you are replacing a designer that you're using with an AI, that is basically a vacuum cleaner taking your money and depositing it somewhere, probably in California. The roads don't get filled, the schools don't get funded. This is why, as communities of people, we've got to think about these decisions together, about what the impacts are going to be on all of us, rather than it just being, oh, for me, I will become more profitable. Actually, what people are finding is that the sweet spot is when, what we call in my organization through research base, a high engagement HR philosophy, which is, if you want to adopt technologies, you talk to people. I mean, my goodness, groundbreaking, right? But you really do need to actually positively engage with people. So you sit them down, like, okay, we're thinking about using this technology now. If we were able to do that, what would that mean for your role, and what would that mean for your team, and what would that mean for the way that your team works with other people? And as we've done that, friends, oh, that's brilliant, because now, if we use that, I wouldn't have to spend 2 hours filling in that spreadsheet, which is really boring, which means I could think about doing that. And it's in that sweet spot that people are able to get the kind of high discretion, excitement part of their jobs, and they become more engaged, more excited, higher skills, better quality work. If you give the low discretion kind of stuff to the automated systems, that's what we're pushing for. Sadly, what is being pushed upon people is taking away the high discretion stuff, because the kind of cheap stuff that just human, grunt, whatever, we can leave that. Those automation decisions are about culture. They are about people. This is where the rubber really hits the road. And I've shared this story before, I apologize for repeating it, but a couple of years ago, we had a fantastic presentation from a lead researcher at Microsoft, and she was telling us about how people who are kind of, knowledge workers with a computer can save X amount of hours, and it's like 10 hours a month or a week if they use Copilot. Our question to her was, what happens to those 10 hours? That is a culture decision. It's a management decision. What could be said is, well, take those 10 hours and go and volunteer at your local food bank, or make sure you go and pick the kids up from school, or go to the gym, or join a social enterprise, or do something else. Or it could be, we want 10 hours more from you. And that decision of intensification has a massive impact socially, culturally, in terms of how a community feels together. We know that good quality work with people having discretion and autonomy and a sense of freedom is what builds a good society. But good quality work is about how we all decide together what are the values we're going to bring to the things that we're going to do you know, these economic management decisions that we've got. This is profound. It's important. We've got to take those decisions together. And the more cooperative firms are, organizations are, the better that process goes.
I think just to build on that, when we were emailing before this, I think Hannah, you brought up the kind of the tendency in this space to sort of accentuate or accelerate existing inequalities and challenges. And I was thinking about that as was listening to the question here in Kester. That 95% stat kind of illustrates that we can speculate a lot about what's going to work and what isn't, and how long-term are the impacts going to be and what aren't they. We don't know. There seems to be enough to merit some experimentation. But what we do know is that it's raising the focus on a lot of the existing challenges and inequalities, and whether yes. that's kind of a sort of narrow drive for efficiency and employment rather than thinking about how can we create more value, whether it's the fact that I do a lot of work with investments in Africa, where there's just a massive gap around data center infrastructure, and so real challenges of how do they have sovereignty there. Those things are not new. None of it's new. It's sort of rooted in decades, if not centuries, of sort of management thinking and decisions. But because we're talking about it in this context of AI, let's make use of that and build on that while we can, while we figure out what's going to be real about this and what's not.
Yeah. Can we throw in one more? Yeah, another question up here. Yeah.
Thank you so much. A question sort of linked to that, like the extremes of AI. So the use of AI in warfare, obviously you were saying, you know, automated weapons, DSS, decision support systems, kind of exacerbating killing, and there's still no transnational treaties like regulating the use of these weapons for political reasons. But I just wonder, you know, what the panel thinks. Like, is regulation going to save us, or is there a risk that for all of the benefits of AI and our personal use of ChatGPT, etc., we're going to end up with, you know, killer robots? And you know, just any thoughts and reflections on that would be really helpful. Thank you.
Go for it.
I really struggled to hear that. I'm sorry, I didn't really hear.
Can we get the mic on again, just very quickly? Yeah. So basically, is there a risk that we end up with killer robots, and you know, are the kind of bad stuff going to outweigh the good stuff, and what can we do to kind of think about that when it's being used for algorithmic targeting, weapons systems, those sorts of things? And yeah, is there legislation and you know, the lack of transnational legislation and so on?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really not placed to answer such big, big political questions. I really don't know. I don't know if legislation will help enough. I mean, look at the state of things right now. Yeah, I've lost my track. I mean, I suppose what I think, I mean, I think when these things were hitting the headlines, they were saying that this can cure, you know, AI can be the solution for war. We'll have no more war. AI can solve climate change. And AI can mean that we can all, you know, spend our time doing things that we want to do for fun and we won't have to work anymore. And in some ways, it could mean those things. Like, we do know how to help the climate and solve climate change. You know, that all of that knowledge is here. We just choose, you know, the ruling classes and the governments choose not to do it. So yeah, like it's not going to cause any of these things or solve any of these things. It's a tool, and the problem is the people who are making the decisions in how we use the tools are not making the decisions that could be made to solve a lot of these huge problems.
Kranzenberg's first law of technology is, technology is neither good nor bad, neither is it neutral. And it basically draws out of us everything that is already existing and is amplifying it hugely. I am positive about regulation and legislation because, in one sense, what else have we got? You know, we have to be positive about engaging democratically. We've got to be able to do that. But that doesn't mean just voting. Democracy is about gathering together as the demos as the people in the public squares, in those spaces. We've got to repopulate those spaces because technologies have actually alienated us from one another, even though they have promised to bind us together. That is the key thing. We need to be reimagining our lives together as democratic people beyond, oh, I vote once every 4 years and it's really annoying because they don't pass the laws that I want to pass. That's not democracy. It's a richer thing than that. And we've got to kind of pull our optimism around democratic structures as a sense of we've got to be optimistic about our lives together as being sites of possibility and change in that. Yeah.
I think with this side, I'm a little bit less positive about the possibility for regulation and legislation, particularly in that domain, because we're in a really bleak time for international agreements.
Yes.
And a lot of the sort of structures that we would have used to establish those are crumbling. And I don't have answers, but I'm thinking about like the Microsoft employees who've been speaking out at all hands meetings and other kind of people within some of the firms that are doing a lot of this work, who are really grappling with some of the ethical challenges of what they're doing and wondering if there are other things that we could do to support people who are in that situation, hook them into other conversations. Hopefully we will find new ways to make international agreements, but yeah, maybe supporting the workers in some of these places who want to think differently is a more tractable thing for us at the moment.
Can I finish with a poem? I think we're out of time and then we're going to be going to the bookshop and doing signings of books. This is a poem called In Those Years by Adrienne Rich. In those years, people will say, we lost track of the meaning of us, of you. We found ourselves reduced to I, and the whole thing became silly, ironic, terrible. We were trying to live a personal life, and yes, that was the only life we could bear witness to, but the great dark birds of history screamed and plunged into our personal weather. They were headed somewhere, but their beaks and pinions drove along the shore through the rags of big where we stood, saying, I want us, us, to think about the we, the people. It's not AI, it's got to be us together. It has got to be us reimagining our lives in the midst of these technologies. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you to the panel. And if you'd like to chat further, please come over to GBooks now. Thank you.
Thank you so much, James, Hannah, and Kester. Big pagoda, thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.